Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Red Fox Blogger with your host, Kel Fritzy. She's the infidel your imam warned you about, and there's no holding her back as she shares her opinions, insights, information, and outrage discussing the political entity known as Islam. We are at a critical juncture in our history, and if the threat of Islam is not faced up front, right now, then we will lose the freedoms of individuality, civic justice, and autonomy of thought we rightly enjoy, and instead see our values replaced with kinetic and civilizational jihad, Sharia law, and oppression permanently. Don't let the memory of our soldiers, past and present, go in vain. It is up to us to protect the legacy for which they fought so hard. We have an obligation to honor their memory today and for future generations. Join Kel Mondays at 3 p.m. Eastern and Fridays at 7 p.m. Eastern on Blog Talk Radio. But leave your political correctness well away from her phone lines and chat room. And be warned, Kel takes no prisoners.
GoDamnMedia.com.
Justified in doing anything we can to survive.
And good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to the Red Fox Blogger with your host, Kel Fritzy and Tim Burton. We have quite a full plate today. I'm going to bring Tim in a moment. I want to talk to you, though, about why we're doing this show, because it's a very important show. I think there's a lot of things out there that people are not aware of. The United Nations and their complicity with the OIC, and that is the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, and what that is doing in the Western world. In particular, Tim and I, we are going to discuss the issue of 1618 and their 10-point plan and what that means to us in the West and how they are going to try to usurp, in the United States in particular, the First Amendment, and that is free speech. They have been working on something, the OIC, our little friends there. They have been working on a convention on combating terrorism. Now, they started this in 1999. Tim and I are going to delve into that. You're going to be shocked when you find out exactly what the 1999 convention actually conveys, what it means. There are only about 2% of the world population who understands exactly what that means. We're going to get into that, but I want to give you a little bit of a background for my new listeners or anybody who's not familiar with what the United Nations is, and because that's also going to be a huge premise of the program today. Is it time to say goodbye to the United Nations? Is it time to push that building into the East River or send it over to Saudi Arabia? Because I think it's outused its purpose. No, the United Nations, it was coined by President Franklin Delano, Franklin D. Roosevelt. Let's just, come on, Kel, quit tripping over your teeth. It was first used by the declaration by the United Nations of the 1st of January in 1942 during the Second World War, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, we know all that. Now, states, they first established international organizations to cooperate on specific matters. The International Communications Union, for example, was founded in 1865 as the Internal Telegraph Union, and the Universal Postal Union was established in 1874. Both are now United Nations specialized agencies. In 1899, the International Peace Conference was held at The Hague to elaborate instruments for settling crises peacefully, preventing wars, and codifying rules of warfare. It adopted the Convention for the Pacific Settlement of International Dispute and established the Permanent Court of Arbitration, which began work in 1902. I am boring you with details, but kids, come on. This is history. Get those notebooks out. Get those pens out. Take notes. Come on, come on. The forerunner of the United Nations was the League of Nations, an organization conceived in similar circumstances during the First World War and established in 1919 under the Treaty of Versailles to promote international cooperation and to achieve peace and security. How's that working for you so far, folks? The International Labor Organization was also created under the Treaty of Versailles as an affiliated agency of the League. The League of Nations ceased its activities after failing to prevent the Second World War. Now, here we are, folks, in 1945. Representatives of 50 countries met in San Francisco at the United Nations Conference on International Organization to draw up the United Nations Charter. Those delegates deliberated on the basis of proposals worked out by the representatives of China, the Soviet Union, the United Kingdom, and the United States at Dumbarton Oaks, United States, in August and October 1944. The charter was signed on the 26th of June 1945 by representatives of the 50 countries. Poland, which was not represented at the conference, signed it later and became one of the original 51 member states. The United Nations officially came into existence on the 24th of October of 1945, when the charter had been ratified by China, France, the Soviet Union, the United Kingdom, the United States, and by a majority of other signatories. United Nations Day, by the way, is celebrated on the 24th of October of every year. So there is your brief history of what the United Nations is, and I hope you enjoyed that little history lesson. Thank you very much. Okay, leave your apples on my desk. Thank you very much. I am going to bring on Tim now, and we are going to delve into this. The United Nations, does it stay or does it go? And Tim, hello, how are you today?
Hello there, Kel. I'm doing well, and how are you? You want a one-word answer to that question? or two words, shall I say?
Frustrated.
and then we can, you know, we'll have the rest of the radio show off and we can discuss other things, you know. But in all seriousness, the United Nations, in my opinion, and I'm just concurring and reinforcing what you said earlier, has obviously outlived its usefulness when you have a voting bloc which basically is always going to vote the same way when it comes to matters involving the Muslim world, and in particular when we've seen just recently any resolution that involves Israel, you just know which way that particular bloc is going to vote. And when you have such a biased partisan group, it's all very well having a special interest group on one or two small matters, but when they vote in such a way, it's effectively hijacking the entire process and making a mockery of the whole reason that the United Nations was set up in the first place. So the short answer to your question is yes, it has outlived its usefulness. We should be considering dissolving it in its entirety and replacing it with something that is going to be far more representative of the interests of the world as a whole, and not just the subgroup which comprises the Muslim Ummah. So yes, there we go. Now, what's next on the agenda? I'm sure you've got another subject up your sleeve, because I knew this was going to be a short discussion.
And ladies and gentlemen, just to let you know that when Tim and I discuss an issue, it is such a consensus, and it's so obvious what the conclusion is going to be. We just say good night, thanks for being here, see you next Monday.
Well, I mean, in all seriousness, there are a load of issues which we should bounce. Oh, yeah. We should bounce around, because, I mean, for one thing, some of our listeners might not be aware of the history of the United Nations and how it was formed. Mm-hmm. I mean, you gave a very good summary of how it was formed right at the start, you know, which is great. And I think I'm right when I say that it took over from the League of Nations shortly after the Second World mm-hmm. War. And yeah. I'm sure at the time that it came into being, the founders of the United Nations thought it was going to be a big step forward. And I dare say, in terms of what the League of Nations had become, it probably was a big step forward. But I don't think anybody could have foreseen back then that it would be taken over by the OIC in quite the way that it has. And the very fact that very few people realize, even at quite a high level in our political elites, there don't seem to be too many people who realize exactly how pervasive the OIC has become and what an influence it has become on the United Nations. It ties in with the topic that we frequently delve into when we're discussing these matters, stealth jihad, because the way in which they have gone about things is not what you would call particularly open and transparent. And it's only when you get people like Major Stephen Coughlin, whose link you have sent to me a little earlier today, and if I get a chance, I'll drop it in the chat room if you haven't put it on your website before now. It's only when we get people like Stephen Coughlin, who was one of the senior government advisors on counterterrorism up until quite recently, that we start to get an inkling of what's actually happening. Now, Stephen Coughlin, for those of you who don't know, was quite a senior person in the Bush. Am I right in saying in the Bush administration? Would that be right, Kel?
I believe it was the Bush administration, yes.
Mm. And when Obama came to power and filled the government up with Muslim Brotherhood representatives, of course, it wasn't long before somebody noticed that Major Stephen Coughlin was actually quite effective in his job, and for that reason he had to go. And I think it was a chap called Hesham Islam who was took quite a senior position in the government and brought it to the point that he was actually, that is to say Stephen Coughlin, was actually trying to link Islam and terrorism, and he was connecting all the dots, and he was being quite successful in what he was trying to do. Mm-hmm. So he had him fired, and now Major Coughlin is he hasn't gone away. He works for the Center for Security Policy, I believe. And
alongside I believe he also works alongside, and I'm just trying to find my notes here, because I wrote copious notes, and of course my desk is a total mess.
Okay, well, the point is that as a voice in the counter-jihad movement, he hasn't gone away by a long shot, and there are lots of links and videos relating to
Frank
his work.
Gaffney.
Frank Gaffney. And he is blessed with a way of explaining things to lay people, which is very, very... brings things into a very, very sharp perspective and explains things very, very clearly. So he's a very knowledgeable person, and more to the point, he can impart that knowledge to people like us and our listeners in such a way that we can immediately see that it ties in with what we already know. And that in this instance, the OIC that we're discussing is trying to push its agenda using the United Nations as a vehicle through which to do it, and is disproportionately influencing the policy of the United Nations to the point where it's to the detriment of the rest of us. I mean, you've only got to look at, is it Resolution 1618? I'm working off the top of my head here. The one that would limit free speech, if it was ever, if it was ever passed into law, we would have our free speech curtailed severely insofar as we wouldn't
well,
be able
yes,
to...
Well, yes, and that's the entire premise of the program today, isn't it, is that we are... We have the United Nations in our crosshairs. It's primarily, though, the OIC that we're concentrating on, and it's because of the United Nations that the OIC was able to garner as much power as they have, and it is the 1618, and they were fomenting that in 1990 when they came out with the Cairo Declaration.
Yes.
And we should have seen the trouble back then in 1990.
We should indeed, and we didn't pay sufficient interest. I mean, now it's becoming apparent that the Cairo Declaration of Human Rights is pretty meaningless because, as Stephen Coughlin explains in one of his videos, you've only got to look at the last two articles of the Cairo Declaration of Human Rights
mm-hmm.
to realize that it's all subject to Islamic Sharia law. And not only that, but Islamic Sharia law forms the basis and only reference for the entire declaration. So
mm-hmm.
in terms of a document for human rights, well, it doesn't bear any resemblance to what we would normally understand as human rights at all. But of course, when they present it as a document that outlines human rights, of course, a lot of people don't look much deeper below the surface than that, and they think, oh, what do you know, the Islamic world has got human rights as well. What were we all worried about? Let's go back to sleep. And I'm sure that is the stealth component that I was referring to a little earlier.
Mm-hmm.
It's designed to keep us at a level of awareness which is so low as to be completely ineffective until such time as the draconian restrictions on freedom of speech and all the other things that come with the Islamic Sharia are stealthily passed into law, and all of a sudden we wake up and realize that laws have been passed while we have been asleep, and it's a completely different world. And by that time, of course, it would be very difficult for us to counter it. So we need to understand it at this stage. And your history lesson at the start of the show was extremely welcome. Here's my apple.
Thank you very much, Grasshopper. A lot of people, what they don't... A lot of people, too, Tim, is what they don't understand about this Cairo Declaration and how they are trying to combat racism or anything along that line. Freedom of speech, everything is encompassed in this 1618 manifesto, and I call it a manifesto. The UN is so complicit in it. It's frightening, especially when it comes to the 10-point plan. I am very, very disturbed by the fact that it is based on Sharia. A lot of people do not understand that. We think, oh, you know, the IOC, maybe it's not such a bad gang after all because they're trying to combat terrorism and they're trying to establish human rights. However, it is based on Sharia. One thing that people also have to understand is that when they talk about combating terrorism, as they were bringing up at the convention in 1999, what they meant by combating terrorism is that if you harmed a Muslim, you were engaging in terrorism. That is Sharia. People read these. The websites are all in English. It's all very nicely written out, very pretty, very open, very democratic. It looks great on paper. You have to really get to the fine print, and there are many things in here. They talk about, well, you should not be slandering religions, i.e. we mean that you cannot be slandering Islam. People have to understand exactly what this organization is all about and how dangerous it is and why the OIC and, of course, the United Nations has to go, because this is probably one of the latest threats to the West, as it were.
Well, yes, and as you say, the devil is in the detail, and I'm sure they are relying on the fact that very few people bother to dig beneath the surface and see exactly what is involved. And when an organization like the United Nations is taken over by a group that represents 56 countries plus the Palestinian it's not a state. It's how would you describe it? The Palestinian entity. You don't describe it as a state.
The failed gypsy roamers. But just to give people an idea.
Okay. I wasn't actually going to go down. I wasn't going to go down.
Oh, that's another road we could definitely go down. But to give people an idea of what the United Nations Human Rights Council Resolution 1618 is, and of course that is the OIC creation, Resolution 1618, combating intolerance, negative stereotyping, and stigmatization and discrimination, incitement to violence, and violence against persons based on religion or belief, that was adopted by the UN Human Rights Council in March of 2011. Among its many specific points, it highlights barriers to religiously tolerant societies and provides recommendations on how those barriers can be overcome. The resolution calls upon all member states to foster religious freedom and pluralism, to ensure religious minorities are properly represented, and to consider adopting measures to criminalize incitement to imminent violence based on religion or belief. Other recommendations include creating government programs to promote inter-religious tolerance and dialogue, training government employees to be sensitive towards religious sensitivities, and engaging in outreach initiatives. And we can see right through that. Tim and myself, we see right through that. And we have very, very smart listeners. You guys see through that too. And this 1618 initiative, by the way, yes, based on the Sharia. A lot of people don't know that, Tim.
Well, yes, and it all comes back to when you look at the what it says in the Cairo Declaration of Human Rights, as Stephen Coughlin said, you can pretty much ignore the first 23 out of the 25 articles, because the last two articles basically say, no matter what we said earlier on in the first 23 articles, what we meant was that everything is going to be subject to Sharia law. That's Article 24. And Article 25 says that the only source of reference for the Declaration of Human Cairo Declaration of Human Rights is Sharia law. So you might just as well have dispensed with Articles 21 to 23 and just put those two in, and it would have made just as much sense, because that is precisely what they meant, and they spelt it out very clearly there. And of course, everything else that follows on from that, any other resolutions that they draw up, are going to be tied in very tightly to that declaration. So it's it's not apparent to a lot of people, but it needs to become common knowledge, because it's just another facet of the stealth jihad that we've been talking about many times on the show before, and it needs to be brought out into the open. I mean, that's one of the things about a stealth jihad. It's only effective as long as it's stealthy. When when somebody, I think I used an analogy the last time I talked about it, and I said, well, you just imagine a cat creeping up on a mouse in a stealthy manner, of course, and if he's got an alarm, if he's got a little bell round his collar on his neck, and the mouse hears the little bell going, he's going to wake up and he's going to be off. And that's what we need to do, is we want to fasten that little bell around the collar of the cat, so that when it tries its tactics of stealth jihad, we can point it out, and everybody should realize, that would be, well, that would be the goal, everybody should realize that they are trying to pull a fast one. They are trying to pull the wool over our eyes while we are not paying attention, and they will continue to try and do that until it's too late, until either demographics have overtaken us, in which case they won't need to worry about being stealthy at all, or until they get all the resolutions they want passed into law, and we are unable to respond effectively because we've had our main weapon of free speech taken away from us. So we have to sound the alarm at this early stage, and no doubt there will be people on the left who will call us, wait for it, racist, bigoted, fascist, Islamophobic, and all the rest of it. But we have to put up with that.
Something else, too, is that we have to be very careful about is that when we read these sort of documents, the wording is so ubiquitous. It's almost like we're getting snowed over again. It seems like we're always in a perpetual state of a Tet Offensive. You know? And it's like we're surprised again. Well, why should we be surprised? I mean, people should know this stuff. And this is why I get very, very upset, for example, with Hillary Clinton, former Secretary of State of the United States, in that she has been going along with all of this. And a lot of people say, well, maybe she didn't quite understand. Well, you know what? It's her job to understand this. This is affecting the West. And when this is affecting the United States in particular, down the dominoes go. The wording, the constant surprises that are being thrown at us, Tim, is just, it's overwhelming. Like, it's amazing that our governments are not even aware of this. They don't even seem to understand. They can't even read a simple book like the Quran.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's a huge problem, is that the people at the top are, I say they're clueless. Sometimes I wonder. I mean, when we had, I'm talking about the UK government in particular, when we had Tony Blair as Prime Minister from 1997 up to, I forget exactly what year, might have been 2008, he served 8 years. He served at least 8 years, I'm sure he did, if not a little more. But he was at pains to say, to repeat the mantra at every opportunity about how much Islam was a religion of peace. You know, and back in 1997, we didn't really care too much because at that time, it was not apparent that Muslim immigration was going to take place as fast as it has. The 2001 events of September 11th hadn't yet happened. And so when Tony Blair said these things, we didn't pay too much attention. But of course, after the events of September the 11th, 2001, Tony Blair was still at great pains to say Islam is a religion of peace, and I should know because I have read the Quran. And he was describing how he'd read the Quran on TV I forget exactly where. I'm sure I could dig up the link if I had to. But mm-hmm. he was being interviewed about how much he knew about Islam, and he said quite airily, "Oh, I keep a copy of the Quran by my bedside, and I've read it through several times." You know, as if he was talking about a novel and having read it through like he would. Well, of course he hasn't. If he had, he would never have described it in those terms. But he was describing it in terms that made it quite plain that he was referring to it in the same way that you would read a novel, whereas, of course, if you understand anything about the Quran, you understand that it's not written in chronological order or in any kind of order where you could make sense out of it reading it from front to back. In fact, as I've often said in recent weeks, I'm sure when that Quran was being put together, I'm sure there must have been a conversation going on upstairs with Allah and Gabriel saying, "Now come on, there's a printer's error here. You're going to have to send this lot back to the printers." And I'm sure there was an almighty fuss about it.
Perfect.
But anyway, they ended up with a Quran where the chapters are all in the wrong order, or they are longest first to shortest last. And if you want to make sense of the Quran, you've got to go back and forth referring to additional documentation in the Sunnah, the Hadith and Sirah and so on. And the way that Tony Blair was explaining it, he obviously hadn't done that, and his pretense, I mean, if we had been paying attention at that time, we could have called him out on it and said, you obviously haven't done what you said you have done, you haven't read the Quran. So he at the time was trying to pull over our eyes concerning Islam and its deleterious effects on our society. But then since he left office, we have discovered that he had a deliberate policy of introducing large-scale Muslim immigration into the United Kingdom in order to destabilize the political landscape. And it was a deliberate thing, and it was nothing short of treason, which of course is why during the later part of his tenure as Prime Minister, he amended the treason laws so that capital punishment would no longer apply. Very conveniently, because I'm sure once this is sorted out and people like Tony Blair are held to account, they will be found guilty of treason, because that is exactly what it was. But to go back to what I was originally saying with our leaders, are they clueless? Are they just displaying abject dimitude? Are they partially affected by the petrodollar? Is it a combination of all three? I suspect it is a combination of all three in varying degrees. But yeah, we are where we are.
Well, the third point that you bring up, because we were dragged into OPEC.
Oh yes,
I mean they pretty much owned us on that one.
Yes, indeed. I remember when as far back as 1973, they were flexing their muscles there. And we ended up with petrol shortages in our country. I mean,
yeah.
I imagine it probably would have been throughout the West at that time, but I was acutely aware of it in our country in 1973, because I had to queue up for petrol rationing. And I remember thinking at the time, oh, this is just something local that will blow over, because I wasn't really politically aware back in those days. But I imagine that was just the first example of OPEC flexing their muscles and finding out just how powerful they were when they got together in a group and they could hold the West to ransom.
So let's make nice and keep the Muslims nice and happy, and let them do their thing, and let them infiltrate the UN, and let them infiltrate the Western world, and everything will be fine. Another reason, Tim, I'm just going to go off for a minute here, because this is my thing. This is my big Canadian thing. This is why we have to get off the oil, the Saudi oil. Please, I implore you, support the Keystone XL pipeline from Canada. Thank you. Okay.
That's very good, Kel. I'm most impressed with that. I think what should have happened is on September the 12th, 2001, the day after the terrible events of September the 11th, obviously, somebody at the top, well, President Bush in particular, should have organized something along the lines of the Manhattan Project in order to get us off Saudi oil and found alternate sources of energy that could be developed and brought on stream. You know, it might have taken 5 years, 10 years, but by now, if he had done that, the United States and Canada would more than likely be self-sufficient in oil and gas and for their energy needs for the next, 50 years, I would have thought. But that wasn't done. And consequently, we are now in a place where we're being held to ransom by the Saudi petrodollar, which on its own wouldn't be so bad if they weren't using the revenues to export the Wahhabi Salafist ideology through the Western world, which will have a terribly destabilizing effect if it's not stopped and reversed. But that, you know, we can argue till we're blue in the face what should have been done. We are where we are now, and we have to make as many people in positions of influence aware that of not only make them aware of what's happening, but to let them know that we know as well. And if something is not done, then we are going to rise up through, well, hopefully through the ballot box. When I say rise up, I use that in a figurative fashion, because obviously I don't myself want to see blood in the streets. But if we don't change things in a peaceful manner and get rid of this threat through the ballot box, then those who make peaceful revolution impossible will make violent revolution inevitable. And I did think it was Voltaire that said that, but I've been corrected since then, and it turns out it was John F. Kennedy. But there you go.
The thing though is that we are in endangerment. Our freedom of speech is being taken away. In Canada, we don't have freedom of speech. We're not fortunate like the United States, where they have the First Amendment. We have freedom of expression, but that will be eroded. And the First Amendment of the United States is under great threat with the IOC and the 1618 clause. It is probably one of the most dangerous things that is going to come across our democracies. And the United States being a republic, I know they hate that word, but I use that as a collective. So, oh, and they hate that word too. Sorry, my friends. But one thing that disturbs me is that President Obama and his Justice Department, what they're doing is that they're warning the social media to, about spreading information that could be considered inflammatory against Muslims, and they're threatening it would constitute a violation of civil rights. Okay, since when criticizing a political entity or a quote-unquote religion, criticizing that, having a dialogue about that, since when would that be considered a violation of civil rights? What happened to that? This is something that really bothers me. We're considered, if we talk about Islam in particular, I mean, we can walk around, and I'm borrowing very heavily on Stephen Coughlin, but he brought up in that video something very, very salient. We can walk around and we can say, oh, you're a dirty Christian, or you're a dirty Jew, or you're a dirty Hindu, or you're a dirty whatever. But if we say you're a dirty Muslim, watch out. All of a sudden, here come out the human rights tribunals, and here we go again. And we've got this usurper in the White House actually warning social media to shut up and don't criticize Islam. This is 1618. This is what's going on here.
The thing about social media and the internet in particular is it's an extraordinarily powerful tool, and I'm sure the people at the top in the Obama administration are very well aware of this, and they want to be able to, if not shut it down, then control it. I'm sure that's the case, because if we are allowed to continue to make people aware, I believe that the process of making people aware is going to proceed in not just a linear fashion, but in an exponential fashion. I mean, if I tell one person today, that person might well tell two people tomorrow, and those two people mm-hmm. might well tell four people the following day, and so on. And so it's a very, very powerful tool. Well, I suppose you could say the internet as a whole is a very powerful tool, because you've got all the alternative sources of information, such as blogs and associated websites. You've got social media such as predominantly Twitter and Facebook, although I'm sure there are other groups as well, but those are the two most well known. And you've got things like Blog Talk Radio, which of course we're using right now. And these are things that nobody had 5, 10, 15, 20 years ago, when there were similar threats to the established order with past generations in different societies and different civilizations. The man in the street, if you like, had very little chance to process the information and to be able to act on it in a way that was in his best interest. I mean, what would happen, I don't know, 100 years ago or at the time of the French Revolution, 200 and a bit years ago, I'm using that as an example, where things had got really bad for the French population. But even so, they didn't share ideas in the way that we can share them today. They had to wait for a few firebrands to organize them before they could rise up and overthrow the established French aristocracy. I mean, I'm simplifying here, okay? I'm sure the French Revolution was a bit more complex than that. But the point that I'm getting at is that it was relatively easy for people who had a stranglehold on society in those days to watch out for these firebrands springing up in their ones and twos, to take them away and execute them before they had a chance to influence or disturb their way of life.
Yeah.
Now,
I'm quite fond of the history of the French Revolution, Robespierre.
Well, I certainly think there's a good case for bringing back the guillotine, but I mean that's another matter altogether.
Which is interesting. The man who invented the guillotine, he was subjected to it in the end.
Oh, well, you know, karma. Hey,
now, that's the ultimate irony.
the point I was trying to make was today, if we have an idea that we want to share, that we think, you know, we think something is fundamentally fair, such as the infiltration of Islam into our Western societies and the threat to our Judeo-Christian civilization, we have the means to disseminate the information to people in terms that they can relatively easily understand in a microsecond, and we can spread it around the world, and lots more people will wake up a lot more quickly in order to counter the threat. And I feel quite sure that if we can only continue to do what we're doing, that we will prevail, because, as I've said it many times, we have the truth on our side. We have a means of disseminating that truth that wasn't available to previous generations who wanted to make a difference in their society. And we have an unjust system of political elites throughout the West whose vested interest is in keeping things exactly as they are, and they don't care how bad it gets with Muslim infiltration, as long as they can keep the lid on it until they can retire with their gold-plated pensions to their Caribbean island. Why should they worry? If the brown stuff hits the air cooling device, as we like to say over here, then they'll be well out. They'll be well out of it, it will be soon. But we need to be able to help these.
They're living in the mansion on the hill. Where are the unwashed masses actually living at?
Yes,
and you're right, Tim. Like it's I'm in my Gita community, and I'm not speaking only figuratively. That is literal. They live in these gated communities. Do you think that they would have all these Muslim yobs living amongst them in their neighborhoods? They don't see it. They don't see it on the streets. They don't venture into Luton, for example. They don't venture into Scarborough in Toronto. They don't venture into Dearborn, Michigan. They don't see it. We're the ones on the streets living it. They don't care. And you're right. It's all about the gold-plated pensions and everything else. And if I can go off on a tangent, I went into my friend Blazing Catfur, and he wrote a blog yesterday, and we have yet another case of Islamic prayer being allowed in our public schools, and I brought that up with you and Jeff and Tommy yesterday on Jeff's program.
Yes, I recall.
So I sent the article. I copied and pasted it, and I put it in a email to Liz Sandals. I said, what are you going to do about this? What are you going to do? And I got a form letter in the email this morning. Thank you very much for your interest. The letter has been forwarded. I'm never going to hear this again. But when I was sending it, I said, is this good enough, Liz Sandals handlers? Because I had been dogging Liz Sandals. She's the provincial education minister here. And I had been dogging her for like 6-7 months, and she would never reply. And I said, look, there's something going on here. And I'm just bringing this around in full circle, people, just to tie back into what Tim is saying, is that the politicians, they really have no concerns because they're living in their ivory towers and they are getting their gold-plated pensions. They're going to retire and they are going to move into the sunshine areas. Right, Tim?
Well, yeah, that's absolutely right. And they can do that because the way our democratic system has been set up. When I was growing up, more years ago than I care to mention, the democratic system and the parliamentary system that we had, certainly in the UK, was presented to me as the best of all possible worlds. And certainly, excuse me, when I was growing up in my teens and I first started to take an interest in how our political world worked, it certainly seemed to be a big improvement on anything that had come before. And there have been one or two politicians who notably have said the same thing. I think it was Winston Churchill who said that the democratic system or the voluntary system is the worst possible means of government apart from all the others, by which he meant obviously that as bad as it was still a lot better than what had gone before. So I looked at it and I thought, well, people approach it with a sense of goodwill, that is to say, if you have a citizenry who by and large are inclined to goodwill in matters of how they relate to each other in a society and how they elect their representatives to speak for them in government. If everybody in that process has goodwill towards the process, then it actually does work very well. But where it falls down is that if you have people who are disdainful of the process and who are allowed to influence the democratic system in ways which run contrary to what most of us would wish, then it is actually that is a flaw which allows very bad things to happen, and now we are seeing the fruits of that, and it's taken along. It's because we didn't back in, I'm talking about the 50s and 60s, we didn't have the effects of cultural Marxism fully taking root in the way that they have done now. And if there had been no such thing as cultural Marxism and the associated political correctness and multiculturalism that went
mm-hmm.
with it, we might well have persisted in our illusion that the democratic system was going to work very well forever and a day. But of course, the political correctness and the multiculturalism that accompanies or is the direct result of cultural Marxism crept up on us in such a stealthy way that by the time we realized it, which has only really been in the past decade, that we realized exactly what a stranglehold that is now having on us. And now we're going to be faced with a very much bigger task than we would have been faced with if everything that we see today had been pointed out to us by knowledgeable people who were allowed to spread their message 30, 40, 50 years ago. But of course, 50 years ago, we didn't have the means of publicising that message anywhere near as effectively. But today we do. So we are where we are. But I'm hopeful that when everybody realizes exactly what is happening and how it has been allowed to come about and what we might do about it, then things will change and we will be able to take those steps much more effectively than we would have been able to in the past.
And I could not agree with that anymore. I have a clip here that I want to share with our listeners, Tim. This is the Organization of Islamic Cooperation and how it is one of the most dangerous entities. I'm going to allow both of us to come up for air, and I want you folks to take a listen to this. And Tim and myself will be back in a few moments.
Freedom story out of Washington. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is meeting this week with representatives of Muslim nations. The stated aim is to fight religious intolerance and discrimination. But religious rights advocates say the Organization of Islamic Cooperation wants to make criticizing Islam a crime and fear the Obama administration won't hold the line.
And joining us now with more on this issue is Frank Gaffney of the Center for Security Policy. Frank, what is the Organization of Islamic Cooperation and what are its goals at this conference?
Let me just give you his background. The president has taken great exception to the claim by many Republican candidates for his job that he's engaged in appeasement. There is no more, I think, powerful example of the president's appeasement than what he's doing as we speak with this group, the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, or OIC. The OIC is, I think of it as kind of a multinational Muslim mafia. It is 57 states and Palestine that have come together to promote what is fundamentally the agenda known as Sharia. That is a totalitarian political, military, legal program that would force all of us, Muslim and non-Muslim alike, to submit to its barbaric, repressive, supremacist agenda. Mm-hmm. The OIC is seeking to do that first and foremost by trying to get the United States, which, after all, has a constitution that guarantees our rights, not just to freedom of religion, but to freedom of speech, by getting us to agree that, well, we really can't say anything that might offend Muslims. And the particular people that we're talking about, the OIC, the Muslim Brotherhood, as Eric Stackelbeck just talked about now, in the halls of power of the United States government, are very easily offended, it turns out, mm-hmm. even if you say something true about the Quran, about Muhammad's conduct, about Allah according to the traditions of Islam, let alone about Sharia. So this is a very worrying thing that Hillary Clinton is at the moment trying to find a way to bridge between our First Amendment rights under the Constitution of the United States and Sharia, which says you don't have those rights as a practical matter.
Why is the Obama administration meeting with this group in light of what you say there?
Well, I think it, again, comes down to the kind of appeasement that we've seen President Obama engage in throughout his time in office, his successive Muslim outreach campaigns, calling us a Muslim nation, getting NASA to make reaching out and pandering to the Muslims a top priority, and bowing to the Saudi king. I mean, on and on. Those are some symbolic. This is much more tangible, as I would argue are two other things that are also afoot. We now have guidelines that have been recently promulgated by the Department of Homeland Security to tell all of the trainers and the materials that they use to train people in our government at state, federal, and local levels in how to deal with what the administration euphemistically calls countering violent extremism. That used to be called euphemistically by the Bush administration terrorism. Mm-hmm. In practical matters, it's countering jihad. Well, under these training guidelines, we have to get the permission of what amounts to the Muslim Brotherhood in our so-called Muslim community leaderships to tell the people we need to train how to counter the enemy. This is a formula for disaster. And then finally, we've got now Senator Dick Durbin in the United States Senate trying to prevent the reauthorization of a critically needed group, really the last official, albeit independent, congressionally mandated institution in our government called the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom that has been monitoring and warning against and trying to hold accountable those who adhere to Sharia and others who are suppressing religious freedom around the world and, for that matter, trying to do it here as well. This group, the U.S. International Religious Freedom Commission, must be kept going. Senator Durbin has even indicated that he's trying to get a prison turned over to the U.S. government that the Obama administration says it would use to house Guantanamo Bay detainees
Illinois.
These are crazy things to be doing.
We're just about out of time, but real quickly, what's the motivation, you think, for trying to silence the commission and to get rid of it?
Well, as I say, there's a gambit here by Senator Durbin to do this prison deal, but I think fundamentally it's really this larger idea of submitting to Sharia. Senator Durbin has also indicated that he wants to get rid of all of the current members except basically one or two, mm-hmm. including one who is an Islamist. And to turn it over to them would be to turn this vitally needed watchdog into a lapdog. I hope people will get in touch with Senator Durbin and their own senators and try to prevent this miscarriage from taking place.
Indeed. Frank Gaffney, thank you so much for your time. Your insight is much appreciated.
Thank you.
Now, isn't that interesting?
Mm.
Tim, listening to that, and that was Frank Gaffney, ladies and gentlemen. I was taken by what he was talking about. Well, there was something that stuck out to me. Like, it really stuck out like a sore thumb to me. And he was essentially talking about the 9/11 Commission. And when the 9/11 Commission came out, it was heavily laden with Islamic terminology. The OIC had ensured that a lot of the terminology would be deemed racist or against human rights, or it would be against the American Constitution, the people within the Constitution. And so that 9/11 Commission, it was totally redacted. That bothers me. That is the creeping. That is the tentacles of this OIC. That the capabilities that they are capable of, the capabilities that they are capable of doing. Okay, I think I made a Dr. Seuss right there.
Yeah, I think I understand what you mean. I mean, as I understand it, the organization was, or the commission, rather, the 9/11 commission was doomed right at the outset because the influence of the OIC was so pervasive that they couldn't possibly come up with any recommendations that would offend Muslims. And, you know, we saw it. Well, we saw a number of things that came up in the wake of the events of 9/11. Not that I'd necessarily think the 9/11 Commission had anything to do with it, but the various memorials that were being promoted, there was at least one which had a great deal of Islamic symbolism in the memorial.
That was in Pennsylvania. Yes,
that's right, the one in Pennsylvania. And when I first saw this, I thought, how on earth could they have allowed such symbolism to creep in? And it just goes to show that, it wasn't just an accidental thing. There was so much in the way of Islamic symbolism, it just could not have been accidental. Somebody had, at a very high level, had approved the memorial with so many aspects of Islamic symbolism, it would be nothing more than an Islamic triumphal monument to what had actually occurred on 9/11. And the very fact that it was even allowed to get to the stage where it could be subjected to approval, for planning approval, as it were, before anybody really realised what on earth was happening, it just goes to show how far people who are sympathetic to Islam in this country, just how far their tentacles have spread. I mean, that's, I know that's not necessarily directly related to the 9/11 Commission, but it was another example that jumped out at me while you were talking about it, because the whole idea of the 9/11 Commission was to, in some ways, redress the balance and to at least be able to say to the American people, well, okay, a great wrong was done to us. We may not actually want to go to war with the Muslim world because of it, but we are going to make damn sure that the United States or the Western world is not going to come out worse as a result. I mean, that would have been a reasonable approach for a commission like the 9/11 Commission to take, but of course it never turned out like that because of the influence of all these other groups and people that were sympathetic to the Islamic goals.
There's something else too, and you're right about that, Tim, about the Islamic goals, and one of those goals is something that the IOC has adopted, and they have adopted it very handily, and that is the issue of racism. We are all familiar with Islamophobia. Now,
excuse me for chuckling. The number of times I've had to deal with that concept in the past 6 months. There's no such thing as Islamophobia, but we're still, even now, getting it rammed down our neck that it's something very real and that it's something that we must all fight against, when, of course, it's not real at all. And we shouldn't be fighting against it. We should be exposing the underlying agenda. But I'm pinching your thunder, Kel. I'll let you elaborate on what you were going to say. But I just get this so much.
Oh, no, absolutely, Tim. I was just going to elaborate on the fact that Islamophobia, that coined term, that was adopted by the Muslim Brotherhood. They coined that, and it was the IOC that ran with it. But what they're doing with it now, Tim, is frightening. We hear, well, Islam is not a race. Islam, you know, there's all sorts of biological groups within Islam. But what they are doing right now is that they are turning it into cultural racism.
Oh yes, that was one of the themes that Stephen Coughlin was developing.
Yes.
in his video number 5, which was the one I was looking at a little earlier.
And I put the link, and Tim, I put the link in the chat room for our listeners.
Oh, great. Okay. Well, yes, if you have an opportunity to look at that video in particular, I took a brief look at one or two of the others as well, and they look like they're all worth watching, but it will take a certain amount of time if you want to work your way through them. But this particular one seemed to be a way of circumventing the common argument that we would put up against Islamophobia. People say to be against Islam is Islamophobic and it's racist. Well, anybody can take that apart. Anybody with any common sense can take that apart, because obviously Islam is not a race, and it's only a phobia if there's nothing to fear. But of course, the way that Islam is threatening our civilization in many and varied ways, to say that there is nothing to fear is ridiculous. And we don't have Islamophobia, we have Islamorealism. But the point that Stephen Coughlin was making was that the OIC are trying very hard to redefine what racism actually is. And in a lot of the documents that they're bringing out now, they're talking about contemporary forms of racism, which is not racism, but what they mean is anything that is defamatory to Islam in particular. And they're phrasing it in such a way, again, that they're hoping, I'm sure, that people of goodwill like you and me don't notice. But again, it's another one of those things where we need to be fixing that little bell around the collar of the cat so that it's ringing out loud and clear to every single person of goodwill who wishes to make a difference. And that's a very pervasive phrase now, contemporary forms of racism.
It very much is so.
Yeah,
it's amazing. Tim, it's amazing how they can change the lexicon like that. And now it's not only, like, racism, for goodness sake, that was a biological issue many, many decades ago. Of course, we're still dealing with the issue of racism. But for them to turn around and turn it into cultural racism, just don't know what to make of that one. And, of course, this is the IOC. Only they could come up with that one.
Well, I think when you start looking back into the origins of, I referred earlier to cultural Marxism, which was the brainchild of the Frankfurt School, amongst others, back in the 1920s, 1930s, and the way in which they were going to introduce the concepts of political correctness and multiculturalism and so on and make them acceptable was to subtly change the way in which we think about certain ideas. And that included changing the meanings of words so that they no longer meant what we thought they meant. Now, I suppose One of the first people to sound the alarm on this was a writer by the name of George Orwell when he wrote a book called 1984. And again, if you haven't read that book, I suggest that you get hold of a copy and you read it.
I have that book in my library. I've read that little long in the tooth. When that book first came out, I read it when I was a teenager, and I read it again in my 20s, and I read it again in my 40s. It's not a long read, but it is probably one of the most enlightening reads. And yeah, when did he write that? He wrote that what?
1948. And it was the fact that the last two digits were transposed because, you know, he thought that, you know, in less than 40 years' time, that would be a reasonably accurate picture of what was happening. And one of the phrases that jumped out at me when I read that book as a teenager, one of the phrases that jumped out was one of the characters in the book said, "Words mean what we want them to mean." And I thought, well, that's crazy. You know, words mean certain things, and those things are fixed in my naive teenage way. That's how I thought the world worked. But in fact, if you are careful in what you do, and you do it over, you allow a sufficient period of time for concepts move around in the national consciousness, the meanings of words can be changed. And that's exactly what we're seeing with racism. When I grew up in the 1950s and 60s, racism meant that you didn't like foreign people with a particular skin color that was different from yours. That was what racism was. And when I was growing up, yeah, there was a lot of casual racism because I grew up in an area of South London where we didn't see very many people at all of a different color at all to us. And then when we did start seeing them, because they were different, the natural thing to do was to make fun of them. That was a natural thing back in the 1950s and 60s, and I suspect it's a pretty much a natural human reaction. Whenever you're confronted with something unfamiliar, you make a little joke about it, just to show that you don't mean any real harm, but you recognize that there is a difference. And I'm pretty sure that you could apply that rule, broadly speaking, to pretty much any human society since the beginning of time, or since the beginning of human society anyway. But now it's being criminalized to the point that if you dare to point out that there is a difference at all, then you're guilty of a very serious crime indeed. And that's just skin color. And okay, as you grow up, you think it's wrong to discriminate against people just because of their skin color. That's fair enough. We've moved on from there. So you probably won't find many people in mainstream, certainly in mainstream British society, and I suspect it's not that different in most Western societies now. Most reasonable people will say that it's wrong to discriminate against people just because their skin colour is different. But if you then start to broaden the description of racism to include culture, or religion, then you're opening up a whole different box of what are those little squiggly things called? Worms. That's it. You're opening up a whole box of worms, and I think it's a very, very dangerous
can of worms.
A can of worms. It's opening up a very, very dangerous path to go down. But nevertheless, they're determined to do it because they understand that we have seen through the claim that to criticize Islam is racism. They know we have seen through the claim that Islamophobia is unjustified because it's not unjustified if there is a real thing to be feared of or concerned about. So now they're saying that any form of criticism of Islam at all is racism, and they're hoping to use that as a dog whistle term, as it were, to shut us up and stop us talking about it. The meanings of words do change, and not for the better, I might say, in a lot of cases.
No, and it's the Muslims that are switching things around. I mean, see, this is another reason why multiculturalism is a doomed experiment. It's a huge fail. I was listening to a program over the weekend, and that is No Way, and he has a program at Reactionary Speaks Network. Reactionary Speaks Network, and that is their No Way Out. And I was listening to him, and he had a barn burner of a show on Saturday.
Mm-hmm.
I literally stopped what I was doing. I couldn't believe what this man can talk. He is a great orator. I was listening to him, and he said something so profound that I was listening in archives because I was at an engagement Saturday night, but I stopped in my tracks, and I had to wind it back again and re-listen to it, and
uh-huh.
What he said was amazing. He said, look, you want to come here, and you want to assimilate, and you want to be part of the host country, no problem. I welcome you. But if you come over here and you try to change my country and you try to change my way and you try to influence my children, then you've got another problem, buddy, because I'm bigger than you, I'm stronger than you, and I will put my fist through your throat and I will strangle you and I might let go when I see your eyes starting to pop out. And he was so passionate. And I was, I sent him a note after that, and I said, "Oh my goodness, no way! I think that you are probably like it's kind of like ding, ding, ding. That is the show of the week. Just that what he said right there, and he was so totally correct. And I was so wrapped up in his words, and he's right. And when they come around here and the IOC, they come around and they want to change our very constitutions, and they want to come around and they want to tell us how we're going to talk about them. They're going to accuse us of being cultural racists. Are you kidding me? No, that's not going to happen, right, Tim? We're not going to allow that to happen because we've had enough of it. We're on to them, and that's enough. And I was listening to No Way, and I was getting worked up. I was upstairs. I was listening to him on my Bluetooth mobile speaker, and I'm standing there, and I'm literally doing fist pumps in the air because we're so totally onto them, and they get it, and they're afraid. They're on the defensive, and they have nowhere else to go anymore. And I think I just engaged in a Kelly rant.
Well, good for you, Kel. But we do need that sort of level of passion. And it's one thing to be knowledgeable and to be aware, and that is the first thing we must do. Because if you're passionate but you're not sure what you're passionate about, that's not really going to get you anywhere. You need to be knowledgeable and you need to be aware, and I hope what we do on these shows goes at least some way towards making people think about what is really happening, as opposed to what the mainstream media are telling us what's happening and what our governments are telling us what's happening. We're spreading the truth, and we're doing it in such a way through our various media, alternative media, with Blog Talk Radio, with Twitter, with Facebook, with the blogs and the other websites that we can look at for research purposes on the internet. We're doing it in such a way that I'm sure awareness is increasing exponentially. I'm sure it's an exponential thing. And you, every now and again, you get a little example of how well it is working, because sometimes I'm sure there are some people who are engaged in the counter-jihad fight, and they wake up some mornings and they think, why am I doing this? This is such hard work, and it's uphill all the way. Well, yes, it is uphill all the way, but then if it was easy, we probably wouldn't have been in this fix in the first place. And the fact that we have got these means at our disposal should be a cause for great joy, compared to if we were up against impending totalitarianism 50 years ago, and the floodgates had been opened to Muslims coming into our societies 50 years ago, and the internet hadn't been invented, we would have been swamped and overwhelmed by now, without a doubt. I'm quite certain, because the information that we need in order to make everybody aware just couldn't have been spread in the way that it's being spread now. And I say every now and again you get a little glimmer of light at the end of the tunnel. You may have heard me refer to this before, and I'm sure you know what I'm going to talk about. It's a poll that was taken a couple of weeks ago on a politics program on our BBC on Sunday Morning Live. That's the name of the politics program. And the BBC, which of course is run entirely by leftists, were putting together a program, and they hoped to show the English Defence League in a very bad light. And I think they were so confident of what they were doing, they decided to organise a poll saying, should the English Defence League be allowed to have a platform in order to express their views? And I'm pretty sure they were so confident that that their presentation of the EDL being full of far right-wing, extremist, racist, bigoted, neo-Nazi, fascist, Islamophobes, they were so convinced that they had the moral high ground there that they were confident in putting this poll out for people to respond to. And at the end of the Sunday morning show, the results of the poll came through, and you've never seen a more surprised Samira Ahmed in your entire life. Now, she's one of these women who wears a permanently surprised look on her face anyway, but it was even more surprised when the poll came through and it showed 95% of the poll was in favour of the English Defence League having a platform to express their views. And they weren't expecting that. I'm absolutely sure they weren't expecting that at all. So that's what I mean when I say there are indications, and that was a very, very strong, powerful indication that what we are doing is effective, because if the BBC was the only form of media available to the general public, which for a long time it was Let us not forget, until the internet came on stream and we started to develop social tools like Facebook and Twitter and Blog Talk Radio and so on, for a long time, if anybody wanted to know what was really happening in the world, they tuned into the BBC. And that was fine when the BBC was an impartial media organisation. Now, of course, it's staffed entirely by lefties, and anything that doesn't fall into the or follow the politically correct line doesn't get shown. So when you see something like that, it really does bring it home that we have them on the run, because if they'd have known they were going to get a poll 95% in favour of the EDL being allowed to have a platform to share their views, they would never have run that poll. Never in a million years. So that's what I mean when I say we've not only got the truth on our side, we've got a means of dispersal of that truth which our forefathers and our ancestors never had when they were faced with totalitarian threats like we are today. And I think it should encourage us all. It really should.
I could not believe that. When I saw that poll, I was amazed, and there is a parody of a picture of
yeah.
television host, and her eyes are bugged out, and there's a bubble, and it's like WTF.
Yeah, okay.
lady, listen, we're wising up. We're cluing in, and we know exactly what. And Tim, to discuss what you were bringing up a few minutes ago, is that yes, we are the new media now. I don't listen to mainstream media. I listen to I like my mainstream media programs on conservative radio. Of course, I love my Mark Levin. I can't live without that one. And I love my Lowell Green here in Canada. And I love my John Oakley. But for the most part, I listen to citizen journalism because they are the ones conveying the truth. They are the ones who are not afraid to say that, for example, Islam, you're asses, and we don't like you. You're the most hated religion on the planet, and you're not a religion. You're a political entity, so please kindly F off and leave us alone.
I couldn't have put it better myself, Kel.
But you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to give you a chance to refresh your tea. But what I want to do as well is I want to share with my listeners is that the United Kingdom, they underwent a very, very devastating storm overnight and throughout the day. It has been very bad. There's a lot of people without power. There's a lot of people without heat. There's a lot of produce going bad in the freezers unless the heat comes back on, or the electricity, rather, comes back on soon. So I just want, and of course, my friend Tim is from
from Birmingham. Yeah, and thank you, Kel. Kel was very concerned about the fact that I might have lost all my power and not been able to get on touch. She sent me a message which says, if you believe it, Tim, if you've lost all your power, just send me an email and let me know. So I thought, well, yeah, right, okay, Kel. So fortunately,
and then he had to scroll down and see the face. Because
tell me, it's
funny.
No, it didn't. To be fair, it didn't really affect us too much in the Midlands, but yeah. A lot of people south. I've seen the pictures of the fallen trees, and some people have lost their lives. So, in all fairness,
it's devastating. I mean, we're losing our lives due to this terrible thing.
Well,
but I do want to convey to my UK listeners that here in North America, we are all thinking of you. You're all in our thoughts. Me and Tim and myself, Kelly, your grammar.
Yes, better.
We're going to refresh our teas. We're going to see you back here. Yeah, you bet you, Tim. We're going to see you back here in a minute, but I really love this song. I've played it once before. I think I played it about 6-7 weeks ago. This is for my UK friends, and just to let you know that you do have a keeper. We'll see you back here in 3 minutes.
never known a singing. And before I left one more tear hit the ground, I would be the one standing between you and the sound of the round echo.
Mind you, you're listening to your fellow hosts, Kel Fritzy and Tim Burton. That was for our friends in the UK who are experiencing rather devastating experiences weather-wise. But before we continue, I want to acknowledge that I have people in my chat room and I have people listening on the radio, other devices rather. First of all, of course, there's me. I'm Kel, and there's Tim. That's Cat Strangler 101. And no, he does not strangle cats. He just plays a really bad violin. I want to thank Eric Kyle, guest, welcome. Hold Your Awakens, Ravi Ariel, Nachman, and Vito Esposito. Trisha was here a little earlier. I've had people pop in, and I had people pop out. I really want to thank Sue from New Mexico for sitting there with me, and Mark as well. You guys are wonderful. We appreciate all that you do, and you're going out of your way to visit our humble little show. We appreciate it so very much. We also want to thank everybody that listens in archive or who are listening on other devices, because you let us know that we're making a difference, because the numbers tell us. We are trying our level best to bring you an education about Islam, the education that you will not find on the mainstream media anywhere. And Vito Esposito, as a matter of fact, of Radio Jihad Network, he has a program right here on Block Talk Radio tonight at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. Please be there. Mamma mia, no Sharia. But, hey, Tim, I wanted to bring something up with you as well. We're moving into the last leg of the program. When I was researching some of this, it was kind of disconcerting. I was going through article after article. I was looking for things, and one thing that Steve Coughlin brought up in his video too was the green on blue slaughter of our troops, either it be in Afghanistan or Iraq, or whether it be where they're deployed. We have America in particular, well, actually NATO, I should say. Mm-hmm. We have troops deployed in 70 nations right now. But they face perils every single day. The green on blue violence that they have to endure on a daily basis It must be. I was reading this article, and I'm thinking, oh, my goodness, this must be so devastating for the troops that are over there. There is a real issue of moral and emotional harm to our troops. We see that when they come home, sometimes they are shells of men and women. They come home with devastating physical wounds. But the morality and their emotional harm really concerns me. And I'm wondering if you see that when they come... Tim, I got a perfect scenario for you, and you are mm-hmm. still going to be able to relate to this. But okay. when our troops do come home, and they're greeted with derision, especially within our so-called ethnic communities, and we saw that in Luton, and thus the English Defense League was born in mm-hmm. 2009, how does the soldier deal with that? Like, they come home and they're confronted with this derision, and we all know what ethnic group of which we speak. It's that, but it's also an issue of what they see over there, what they see, what they witness.
Well, it obviously has a psychological effect far beyond what you would expect to encounter in pretty much any other walk of life. If you, let's just say you've been promoted to a new job and you're not quite sure what to expect on day one when you walk in there, you at least walk in with a reasonable expectation that the people who are around you, all right, they may not disagree with everything that you want to do, especially if you've been drafted in to clean up corporate culture and to make changes which might be unwelcome. But you've got a reasonable expectation that those people aren't actually going to stab you in the back or shoot you if your back's turned. And to be put into an environment, for anybody to be put into an environment where they just don't know who their friends are, the people who are supposed to be on the same side are just as likely to kill them as the guys that they know are the bad guys that are out there that they're looking to eliminate or take out on a daily basis. But to actually have a situation where you've got no... you've got no way out. You're ordered into a battle situation, and you don't even know whether your friends are going to just pick up a gun and shoot you because they've got some kind of grievance against you. It might be a cultural or a religious grievance, or it might be something personal because you said something to them the previous day or the previous week where mm-hmm. the guy took it the wrong way. And because he's of a different culture, he won't sort of come back and talk it through with you. He'll just pick up a gun and shoot you. Now, mm-hmm. to put our men and women in that kind of position is nothing short of criminal, really. And it's hardly surprising when soldiers come home and they're psychologically harmed to the extent that, well, they might never get over it. I mean, we all thought... it was bad enough. I remember hearing the tales of soldiers that came home after the Great War and who were suffering from shell shock. And this was at a time when psychological trauma was not really understood. And if somebody came home shell shocked, the general position of a doctor would be to say, well, pull yourself together, you know, don't be such a namby-pamby, get over it. And he'd be back out on doing everybody would hope would be a productive job, either back in uniform as a soldier or doing something else in civilian life, and nobody would worry about him. And if he had what we now recognise as post-traumatic stress disorder, that was just seen as a weakness, a mental or psychological weakness. In fact, I don't even think the term psychological weakness had even been coined in those days. He was just seen as weak. And nobody really worried about it. But now that we understand a lot more about what happens to a soldier when he goes into battle and the stresses that he's mm-hmm. faced with, it's nothing short of criminal to put people into positions where you could, if you were a commander who thought ahead a little bit more, if you could think ahead and say, we're putting these guys alongside soldiers who are supposed to be on the same side, but in fact they might just as easily pick up a gun and shoot them. I mean, that's a criminal mm-hmm. situation to put one of our soldiers into, any soldier. If you cannot trust the Afghans with a rifle, then for heaven's sake, don't give them a rifle. And if somebody says, but that's going to affect the ability for us to train them up and so we can get out at the end of 2014 or whatever, you've got to take a step back and say, well, is that worth the lives of our soldiers and the psychological scars that our soldiers are going to come back with because we've put them into an intolerable position? I think that's a terrible thing to do. And I understand that commanders are put in that position by their political controllers. I'm sure there are plenty of field commanders out there who understand this just as much as we do, but their hands are tied. But nonetheless, it's still nothing short of criminal to subject our soldiers to that sort of psychological stress. But I don't know if that's quite the answer you were looking for, but that's
yes,
my immediate thoughts on it.
Exactly. It was exactly the answer I was looking for. I just want to welcome Poppy, who joined us in the chat room. I called her Ploopy. Oh, boy, she's not going to send me a
I'm just looking in
now.
The chat room. I'm just looking in the chat room, and Vito Esposito thinks I'm a radical and very insensitive. Now, I'm not sure quite what he means by that. So maybe he'll... maybe you'll elaborate.
He means you're one of us.
Oh, good. Because I'm he's saying I'm insensitive, but I'm ever such a sensitive soul at heart, and you know, to be called insensitive, well, I might just pick up a rifle and shoot somebody, you know. But
no,
yeah,
I'm glad
that's what he means.
You're one of us in that we care greatly about our troops, and that I'm always grateful for my attitude that I have developed in dealing with the scourge. I'm very insensitive to the scourge, and I don't give a crap what happens to them. It's like hoorah to me. Take them out, ping them off, get rid of them, and quit affecting our troops and quit killing our troops, please, and quit giving us a reason to go over there to protect our democracies and our republics and our freedom of speech, our First Amendments, our Second Amendments, our constitutions, wherever it may be, and let us come home in peace. And plus two, stop the immigration, the Islamic immigration. Please stop the Islamity. Our troops deserve to come home and have a parade and be honored, and we do not need to be there honoring them and see a bunch of thugs standing there on the other side of the street going, baby killers, and that sort of thing. Tim, that's the sort of, like, that's my other angle. And that creates further to the moral deflation and the emotional deflation. And yes, and when they come home from war, and what you were saying, when they were coming home from the last great war, the shell shock, it really wasn't recognized. And it wasn't recognized. I don't think it really came out until, like, even during World War II, they were told to, chin up, come on, you'll be fine. And but they weren't fine. They weren't fine at all. I don't think a lot of awareness of the post-traumatic stress syndrome that the soldiers went through actually came through until the 1970s. And one movie that addressed it beautifully was The Deer Hunter. Another movie it beautifully was Coming Home. And later on, Forrest Gump, when he was dealing with Lieutenant Dan. Mm.
Yeah, I recall those films. And I was just going to add, it's one thing to put soldiers under stress, and at the end of the day, that is what they do. They are highly trained personnel, and they're trained in such a way as to be able to deal with the kinds of stress that you would routinely expect to counter on a battlefield. And those are things that the average person just wouldn't be able to cope with. You know, if I were dropped from my comfortable chair where I'm sitting in front of my computer into a battlefield situation where there were bullets flying all around me and people trying to kill me, I'm quite sure I would not be able to respond in an effective manner. I mean, I feel I can deal with a lot of things most things that come at me in my daily life. But if I was in the middle of a hot battlefield situation where people were trying to kill me, I'm quite sure I wouldn't be able to cope because I haven't been trained to cope, and it's not the kind of skill you acquire overnight. But that's quite different from taking a soldier and putting him in a position where he's subject to psychological stresses because he just does not know who to trust, even supposedly on his own side. And that's unforgivable. That's completely unforgivable. And it's unforgivable because it's avoidable. And if only our political elites looked at the reality of what is actually happening with our war against Islam and took common sense decisions, then a lot of this... a lot of problems could be avoided. I'm not just talking about this particular question of psychological stress, but all the blood and treasure that's been expended in fighting Muslims in Iraq and Afghanistan in the way that we have, we've been fighting a war with one hand tied behind our back most of the time. If we looked at the reality and said, what we have to do, if we're going to go into any kind of hot war at all, we need to be able to go in and we need to win. We don't want to go in and we don't want to pussyfoot around and put our soldiers at risk just to make ourselves look good in Muslim eyes. That's not the goal of that. That shouldn't be the goal of the war. The goal of any war should be to crush your opponent utterly until he is incapable of fighting back. And because we didn't go in like that, that's why we have the problem that we have now.
Tim, you just succinctly read my mind. I interviewed Montgomery Granger two weeks ago, this Friday, in fact. And he's a major of the U.S. Army. He's a reserve major. He was one of the keepers of the detainees at Guantanamo Bay, and he wrote that book, Saving Grace at Guantanamo Bay. Mm-hmm. And I was talking with him, and I was reading his book. I have always espoused, stop it, bring our troops home, and let Allah sort it out over there. He is such a true soldier. He said, you know, that he wrote this in his book, and I was reading it, and I thought, oh, for goodness sake, this man is so correct. He said, people say that to bring the troops home. No, we're soldiers. We go over there, and we don't come back until the mission is done.
Yeah. That is the attitude that soldiers on the ground need to have. But when you're looking at the how am I going to explain this? When a politician takes a decision to send soldiers in, what should really happen in an ideal world is you don't send soldiers in at all unless you absolutely have to. But when you send them in, you unleash them and you let them do everything that they have been trained to do until the enemy is completely crushed. No good sending people into a battlefield situation and say, oh, but you can't walk around with your guns like this.
Be a social worker. Hand out candies to the kids.
Yeah, you.
Oh, my gosh, we have turned our soldiers into social workers.
Well, that's to say that it's quite wrong is just my normal British way of understating things. Okay, it's criminal, and the politicians that have taken these decisions should, in my view, be held to account for them, just like all the other politicians and people on the left and taken various political decisions, not necessarily in battlefield terms, but who have altered our political landscape for the worse. they should all be one day held to account, and I certainly hope they are. But to send soldiers, highly trained soldiers, into a position where they can do nothing more than act as... They might just as well walk around with big targets painted on their backs as they hand out the candies and act as social workers. That's entirely wrong and entirely avoidable. And if our politicians only recognise the reality, which is we are at war with Islam, not radical Islam, not fundamentalist Islam, not Islamism, we are at war with Islam. Or rather, it would be more correct to say Islam is at war with us, and it's never going to stop until either it crushes us or we crush it.
We crush now, there is absolutely no give or take. It's pretty black and white. I just want to share with you, Tim, Vito brought up a really good point in the chat room, and that's Vito Esposito, or Vito Esposito, as Jeff calls him.
Okay.
He says, unlike World War II, our troops, they have no time to decompress. World War troops, they had 2 weeks to get back to the USA and decompress. Today, it takes 14 hours from arena to home. And that is true. They leave the arena, the field of war, and they're on a plane, and they're back home wearing their civvies within less than 24 hours. And they don't have that decompression time anymore. They're taken out. They're put on a plane. They're brought back home. All of a sudden, they have spent they've done a six-month tour of duty in Afghanistan, seeing the worst of the horrors, and then all of a sudden, they're back in their living rooms wearing their chinos again.
Yeah, and I'm sure it's we were talking about psychological stress a little earlier, and psychological stress on the battlefield, not knowing who your friends are, that's one thing. But then when they take you out of that situation, and within 24 hours you drop back in mainstream America, it must be a hell of an adjustment. And that's when you need the support of all your friends and family, and there ought to be a support structure within the fighting forces that deals with returning soldiers and helps them by, I don't know, debriefing them perhaps. I mean, I'm not a soldier. I have to say I don't have all the answers, but it would seem to me that we're not giving our fighting forces the support that they need in so many ways. I mean, it's bad enough when they go out to fight and they're not supported in the field by the politicians who sent them there. They're not given all the weapons that they need to conduct the war effectively. They're not, certainly with British soldiers, they're not even given basic equipment to defend themselves with, such as body armour. A lot of the time, British soldiers have to go out and buy their own desert boots, effective footwear. I know of cases where soldiers have had to go and buy body armor when they've been deployed at short notice and there isn't enough body armor to go around. We have lots of instances of soldiers that have been, certainly British soldiers, I imagine it's true with other coalition and soldiers as well, soldiers that have been killed specifically because they didn't have standard issue defensive equipment, including body armor, to defend themselves against the most basic enemy attacks. We have all of this. And in the middle of it all, our politicians, certainly over here, are trying to find excuses to make further cuts to the armed forces over and above the cuts that were made prior to them going to war, which is absolutely crazy. So there's so many things wrong. And at the same time that all this is happening, our politicians are increasing the welfare benefits to the immigrants that are coming over here and who are swamping us demographically. The priorities are just totally, totally wrong. And all I can say is if we do not address this, we are going to come unstuck as a society, as a civilization, very, very quickly. And it's my opinion that we ought to be able to pull a rabbit out of a hat because of the advantages that we have having the internet and being able to increase awareness to people. But that doesn't mean we've got all the time in the world. We are still under notice that if we don't act within a reasonable time scale, then Islamic, if nothing is done, Islamic demographics will overwhelm us and we'll have a fight on our hands which we may not be able to win straight away.
I think we will.
At the moment.
I'm positive of it. We are in something very, very phenomenal in this day and age. Whether or not it's going to be solved within our lifetime, our lifetimes, we are going to see some very, very, very phenomenal developments when it comes to the East, the West.
I mean, one of the things is that we're fighting a war that we haven't fought before on so many different levels. When I was growing up, war was very, very black and white. The bad guys were in one or more geographical locations, which you knew about. They had, you know, in the case of the Germans, they had some lovely smart uniforms, so you could always tell the difference between a German soldier and a British soldier. And the British soldier would go over there, and he would know that if he saw a guy in one of these nice smart uniforms, he could go and shoot him. And, you know, if the uniform was still wearable after that, he could sort of take it and polish it up, sell it to his mates, you know. But now you can't do that. You can't do that. The enemy is amongst us, and we're fighting a war on a very, very different level. And there is so much in the way of political subversion that's going on that is designed to demoralize us as a civilization, as a society, is designed to demoralize our armed forces so they can't be as effective as they would be in the field. It's a whole different ball game. And the main thing we have on our side is that we have the means of making ourselves aware. And once we have the awareness, we then have it in our own hands to be able to change the situation, either through the ballot box or through convincing like-minded people of the need.
I just hope it's through something, because, Tim, something's got to give. And just to let you know, we are down to our last four minutes of talking points. And
I want
you to tell people why we have to get rid of the UN and especially the OIC.
Well, all right, to come back to where we first started, why have we got to get rid of them? Because it's no longer fit for purpose. The United Nations was set up in place of the League of Nations in order to provide a forum where countries could get together and resolve their differences in a civilized manner. But considering it has been usurped by the OIC, the 56 states, and the gypsy-ridden entity that we call Palestine, or we don't call Palestine, the others do, those 57 entities have effectively usurped the United Nations and made it unfit for purpose. So, we have to get rid of it. I still believe that we need, in a civilized world, we need a means of mediating between countries that have important differences, because we're never all going to see eye to eye all the time on all the things that divide us. I mean, that's just human nature. I mean, it's bad enough when you're just trying to mediate between two children squabbling in one household. I mean, that's hard enough. I mean, I know from experience, and to sort of look at it on a global scale, it's a task that needs to be done if the world is not going to be involved in perpetual war. And the idea is that if you've got effective mediation, then people of goodwill will eventually reach a negotiated compromise, or we'll come to a way of living together without blowing each other to pieces. So, the concept of a body like the United Nations is a good thing, but you cannot allow that body to become usurped in the way that it has become usurped by the OIC. And if it becomes so infested and so usurped in such a way that you cannot untangle the OIC from the effective functioning of the United Nations, then the best thing is to chuck the whole lot in the bin and start again. I know that's easily said than done, but, you know, You know me with all my connections, one phone call, and I'll make sure it's done, Kel. So don't you worry about that.
Oh.
By tomorrow, the United Nations will be nothing.
I love you, Tim.
Will be nothing,
hey.
Will but a pile of dust.
Oh, it was another banner show, my dear sir. What are we going to tackle next Monday?
Well, that's it. Now we've sorted out the UN. We'll have tomorrow and next Monday, I think we should just decide how we're going to work out world peace between us, and then our
okay.
job will be done.
And and that'll be another 5-minute show.
Another 5-minute show. Yeah. Well, I mean, that's
my goodness.
On the subject anyway.
But
yeah, it's something that will have to be done sooner or later. We cannot allow the United Nations to continue to be dominated by the OIC because it will no longer represent the best interests of the Western world. And come what may, the Western world, with all its faults, it's based on Judeo-Christian ideals. And no matter what you might say about Judeo-Christian ideals, how they're not perfect and so on, they are far better than anything that Islam has to offer, full stop. And therefore, we should not, in the interests of humanity, we should not allow Islam or any group that's associated with Islam, we should not allow it to overrun a body like the United Nations. But given that it is overrun, all right, it's like a house that's infested with woodworm or dry rot, you might get to the point where you've got to knock the whole thing down, clear away the rubble, and rebuild. And we may have to do that. But the first thing is to recognize that there's a problem and why there is a problem and how that problem came about so that we don't repeat those problems in the future. And I think that's a little something that we hopefully have contributed to with tonight's show.
I think we have, and I think we have done it stupendously. Tim, once again, it's always a pleasure to have you as my fellow host on the Red Fox Blogger. You bring so much to the table. I am very grateful that you have committed your time every Monday to be here. You and myself, I think that we're making true differences out there. I just want to remind people as well is that Tim Burton, the freedom-loving infidel, he is also a co-panelist over there at Jeff Mitchell's show, and that is the East Anglian EDL radio show, which you can hear right here on Blog Talk Radio, Thursdays, Fridays, and Sundays at 3:30 p.m. Eastern Time and 8:30 p.m. Greenwich Mean Time.
Yes, indeed. And if anybody
I got that right. You won't have to report me.
Well, yeah, that's absolutely right, Kel. We'll get back in the right time zone. We'll be fine. But if anybody has got any specific queries, by all means, you can email me at catstrangler101@gmail.com. Or you can follow me on Twitter.
Oh, heck. I've got your links all over the show page. I even put up a special picture up there, so they have no excuse.
Just a special picture. Thank you very much for that. A violin-playing cat. That's wonderful,
there you
Kel.
Go.
But you spent ages looking for that one. But yeah, you can also find me. You can also follow me on Twitter at followthecat@catstrangler101, and that's on Twitter. So if anybody's got any queries, I'll be very happy to talk to you and discuss them further. So thank you very much for tonight's show, Kel. It's been a privilege and
Tim,
an honor to work with
you
on the show.
You bet. And we'll see you at Jeff's place on Thursday.
Certainly will.
Ladies and gentlemen, I want to thank you very much for joining Tim and myself tonight. It was a fantastic program. I hope we left you with some tools that you can work with. Please go out and educate yourself. Our topic this week, of course, was dismantling the UN and certainly getting rid of the Organization of the Islamic Cooperation. I'm going to leave you with that. You can Google, you can go in there, go to YouTube, listen to what people have to say, just educate yourself, and remember, I am on back here Friday evening at 7 p.m. Eastern Time, mystery guest. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so very much, and remember, it is mass Islamity. We have to stop the insanity. On behalf of Tim and myself, have a wonderful week. Bye-bye.
Yes, yes indeed. Goodbye, everybody. Thanks for listening.